Hey, welcome to the Life 2.0 podcast. I'm John St. Augustine. Glad to have you joining me from everywhere and anywhere on planet Earth. Time to go up the down staircase in the outdoor, make sense out of the senseless, and if at all possible, let's find the obvious buried in the absurd. Let's get to it. Glad to have you with me. As I said just a few seconds ago, I tend to repeat myself sometimes. Radio really is all about repetition. That's how we learn every song we've ever learned. The average human in the United States, I think it's age 58, was the last time I checked the statistic, knows the words to about 3,500 songs. They never set out to learn, but they've heard them so many times that it just becomes a download at some point. Anyway, I am glad to have you joining me. It is, in all full disclosure, 3:50 in the morning on Friday, the 19th of November. And what the hell am I doing up this early in the morning? I wanted to see the partial lunar eclipse. This has not happened for 581 years. The last time there was a partial lunar eclipse this long was in the year 1440. And back then, the population of the planet estimate was about 389 million people. We have almost that many in this country alone now. And the average life expectancy back then was 48. So I think of that 1440 number, and I think that's the same amount of minutes you get every single day, 1,440 minutes, same as they did 600 years ago. And using those minutes wisely is probably a good idea. So that's what prompted me to turn the microphone on at nearly 4 o'clock in the morning. But listen, I've already had a sandwich, a donut, I got some coffee. And it was interesting how, you know, I didn't set an alarm to get up this early. Sometimes it just happens. I am convinced beyond a shadow of a doubt, our subconscious mind is the best GPS and internal wake-up call, if we listen to it, ever invented. So I knew this was coming up, and I actually have it on my calendar. But getting up at 3:30 in the morning, even though I've done it quite often in my life, was like I didn't set an alarm, as I mentioned. Sure enough, at 3:18 this morning, not that long ago, wide awake, bang, what's going on? Oh, that's right, the eclipse. And the fact that human eyes have not seen this, as I mentioned, for 581 years, plus I don't know who figures stuff out like that, Tom Skilling, I guess, I don't know. But that had moment for me. It is truly, 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 and these are few and far between these days, a once-in-a-lifetime experience. I mean, when you think about how much shit comes our way in the media and all other aspects of life, finding something that's rare like that is rare. So I'm sitting here drinking coffee, waiting for the studio to warm up. I got the shades open. I didn't have to go outside because it's 24 degrees out, which I'd do it, but I could stay inside and watch it. I got this huge window that faces the west. And I opened the shade in here, and there it was. And I'm watching this partial eclipse become almost full and then start to back off again. And again, in the big scheme of things, you know, that's pretty big. It's pretty, at least it is to me. And I'm sure there are people up all over the world looking at this spectacle and in a little bit of awe. And in these days, having some awe, AWE, like, wow, holy shitsky, I think that's important. It's easy to get numb to the push and pull and the erosion of life, and to come across something that makes you get up that early, I think it's pretty special. So I won't see it again in my lifetime, and to think that it's been that long since other humans have seen it was just an amazing thing to me. Plus, it ties in, it's a segue of sorts, to another once-in-a-lifetime experience. A couple days ago, let me just see if I can back this up. On November 12th, I found out that my good and great friend, Captain Jerry Coffey, U.S. Navy retired, passed away at the age of 87. And Captain Jerry Coffey was one of the longest held prisoners of war in Vietnam, over 7 years. He was shot down in 1966 and endured unimaginable cruelty at the hands of his captors in the Hanoi Hilton. And Jerry came out of that experience after 7 years and rebuilt his life, and eventually wrote a book about it called Beyond Survival. And I first met him on the air in 1998. My friend Nancy Vogel has a speakers bureau, and she had booked Jerry for several speeches back in the day and thought it'd be a great fit for the show and whatever, and it definitely was. I think we've done 20 shows over the last 25 years. That's a lot. And some, you know, off-air conversations as well. This is another one of these people who have become friends who I've never met in person, which says a lot about not having to be in person to be connected to somebody. And when I got the news, you know, part of me wasn't surprised. He had battled some serious health challenges towards the end of his life. His wife, Susan, just a delightful lady, would always keep me posted on his progress. A few years ago, maybe 3 years ago now, two, 3 years ago, he had some fairly serious things going on, and he was at Walter Reed, and I talked to him there. And so anyway, this is, you know, kind of all going on, and he'd been in my mind the last few weeks, and so I'm not surprised to kind of hear this news, sad news, because again, just like that eclipse, which is a once-in-a-lifetime event, this man was a once-in-a-lifetime occurrence. His main, main message in Beyond Survival was all about forgiveness. And that how, if you don't do that, if you don't take the steps to go in that direction, you remain a prisoner. He used to call it a POW, prisoner of woe, which was his way of kind of explaining that. And so when I found out that Jerry had passed, I went looking for tapes of the shows that he and I did together. You have to understand, I bet I have 10, 12 huge Rubbermaid boxes filled with cassette tapes. Nobody uses cassette tapes anymore. Hopefully they'll come back just like vinyl records have. Who knows? But anyway, I have literally thousands and thousands of cassette tapes of the shows that I've done over the years. And they're just down in the basement, you know, in storage. I got a few of them here in my office. I've gone through and sorted a few over the years. It's a painstaking process. I started to come up with a box of stuff. Okay, this is kind of a priority. This is good. And then this is kind of mediocre. And then this one's over here. What's this shit over here? I put that in that box. And I started looking through the tapes to find this one or two or three what I could find with Jerry. And I didn't go into the basement, into the deep archive. I just stayed with the stuff I have in my studio close at hand. And I started going through all these names of these people that I had spent time with. And listen, I never expected to be doing this for a career. It was a calling back in 1997. But to have a career as I've had in radio is, you know, beyond my comprehension. And so I just keep showing up and see what happens. I started digging in there and looking at these names. And many of them have passed away like Jerry has. Wayne Dyer, Senator Paul Simon from Illinois, who was a great guy and a great friend and a great advocate for the environment. Carol Channing was just hilarious. Christopher Reeve was incredible, the late, great Superman. Earl Hamner, my dear friend Earl Hamner, who wrote Spencer's Mountain and created the Waltons. And Dr. John Ortiz, who was a musicologist. Just amazing. And then there are people who are obviously still here, like Jean-Michel Cousteau and Bill Curtis and Catherine Cryer and Charles Osgood and Pat Buchanan and Juice Newton. Anyway, these are all the people that you would recognize their name, perhaps. There's just as many you've never heard of before. And as I was going back and forth listening to both the known and the obscure, let's put it that way, a pattern emerges. And I didn't always see this pattern because I'm not supposed to. When you're in it, you can't really see it. It's not until you get kind of outside the pattern and you see the connected dots a little bit. And that each of these people, the famous and the obscure, brought something to the radio that didn't exist before they got there. That's obvious. The conversations, to me, first and foremost, I have not listened to many of these tapes for years, so they're all crystal clear. These tapes are not worn out. The second thing is, I start taking notes, which I do not do. I don't have time for it. I don't have the energy for it. I don't have the mind space for it. But I started taking a little note here. Wayne Dyer said this, and Charlie Osgood said this, and Catherine Cryer said this. And so I'm looking for these tapes for Jerry Coffey, and I can't find any, but I'm digging deeper and going down the rabbit hole of these other shows. And for years, years and years, I thought, what am I going to do with all this? I mean, listen, I've had a great career in radio, and it may or may not be totally over. I mean, who knows how things go. Right now I'm doing the podcast. I just finished a year of the Daily Show on called The Bridge with Beijing, and so that may have run its course. We'll see if it comes back or not. But there's always something washing up on my shore, but I always have this microphone. And to me, whether I'm talking to 500,000 people on The Bridge or five of you at, what time is it now? 4:10 in the morning. It's all the same to me. This is what I'm supposed to do. So my point in saying that is, while I've had this great career, it is not like there is this, you know, bustling need for my former content to any great degree, and that I'm going to repackage all this stuff. Taking cassette into digital, kind of a pain in the ass. So I think what I'm going to do, the idea came that since Throwback Thursday is a thing, I'm going to start categorizing some of these older shows that I think have some value. And in addition to mostly posting these podcasts on Saturday, I'm going to start doing a Thursday, Way Back Wednesday or a Throwback Thursday, so I can kind of stagger it. But I may end up pushing some of this to Saturdays. It's easier for me to do it production-wise. But in all of this, I was answering my own question. What's the value of these? I'm the guy hosting the show, and I'm writing notes. So maybe there is some inherent value. You know, conversations that we had, they don't have a time limit or an expiration date on it. Even though these folks may have gone on, their voice remains. There's value in that. So it's an interesting thing for me to get the idea that this resource is sitting there, and it may help someone listening, even though it may be 10 or 15 or 20 years old. And I got to tell you what, my voice over the years, this is the one thing I noticed more than anything else. My voice has dropped dramatically. When I first started, it was way up here. And I guess that's just time, over time, and a lot of coffee, apparently. My vocal cords have loosened up quite a bit. I'm amazed at some of the energy that I had back in the day. But of course, I was younger. You know, I saw things a little bit different. As I started to think about this show with Jerry and all the pieces around it, if you asked, and I mentioned this, I believe, at some point during this conversation you're going to hear in just a couple seconds, I've been asked many, many times over the years, with all the years that you've been in radio and all the people you've talked to, who's the best guest you ever had, or the greatest guest, whatever. And they all fall in different categories, but if there was the most impactful guest, it's Jerry Coffey. You just don't go from being a 7-year-plus prisoner of war in the Hanoi Hilton to someone who writes a book about forgiveness, which always puts any slight or injustice that I may or may not imagine in perspective. If this man can go through what he went through and forgive his captors, who am I to be pissed off and be unforgiving in the things in my life? And so I think that in many ways, Jerry's ability to forgive created to his longevity. I think it added to it. And so while I was very, very, very sad to hear the news that Jerry has passed, I was so very glad to get to know him and to have the conversations that we had over the years. So this is one from 5 years ago. I was with CBS at the time. They had just come out with their Play.it podcast platform. So you're going to hear some of the music in that, and you'll hear our conversation. And as I recall, we had a technical problem in the studio, and we had to do the whole show over. I mean the whole show. It was like 30 minutes. And Jerry at the time was on vacation. He lived in Hawaii. So he's kind of lives where people go on vacation. He had his family there. He was on the beach. He came back from the beach and did the show a second time. Serious respect for him. So this is from my CBS podcast, Life Matters. And this is my conversation with Jerry Coffey. And by the way, you should go find a copy of Beyond Survival from Captain Jerry Coffey. You can read all the great books about how to do things and the theory of doing things. The man lived it.
Glad to have you back. John St. Augustine, actually delighted to be with you one more time and thrilled, really, for this show. I say this every week. I'm thrilled with all the people I get a chance to spend time with. But over the years, doing media for 2 decades now, basically, I'm asked every now and again of all the people that you spend time with and talked with and all the rest of that stuff. You know, who really is at the top of the list when it comes to the time, the energy, and the effort of the message that they put out? Really hard to determine that sometimes as I think about the great voices and the great messages and the great people that I've been so very fortunate to spend time with. But I have to really kind of set it up at the top of the list as a fellow named Captain Jerry Coffey, who is the author of a book called Beyond Survival, Building on the Hard Times, a POW's inspiring story, one of the longest held prisoners of war in Vietnam. When I read this book many years ago, it just stayed with me. I think the first time that I learned about Jerry Coffey was a little cassette tape that Tony Robbins did, an interview with him. I heard it in my car many, many years ago, and it had gone on since then. So when I got in radio in the middle to late 90s, I really wanted to have this conversation. We had some amazing connections over the years. And now that I've come back to CBS, where I started, actually, it was without any hesitation that I got a hold of Jerry late last year. We had a great conversation, and we were able to pull it off today, and he joins me. He's suffering, actually, in Hawaii on the beach. So, Jerry, thanks very much for being patient.
I'm going to sand out of my toes here, John.
Yeah.
Focus more. Hey, listen, it's good to be back in touch with you, my friend, and I'm looking forward to a working relationship here now and in the future. I understand that we've got some more time. We have to do a little more over again. That's no problem. I've got lots of time and ready to go here.
Well, I want to be...
I mentioned that I'm at the beach park at Kailua Beach on the windward side of Oahu. We live on the leeward side, and the windward side is a more tropical and damper side. And Kailua Beach is consistently rates as number one, two, or three by tourists and beach experts all over the world. And it's just a beautiful beach, and I've got my family down here. And not going to let a radio interview interfere with that beach time.
Well,
who says we can't do it all?
That's right. I mean, technology allows for just about everything. And in contrast to that, I'm on the 10th floor of the Prudential Building overlooking a very soggy, cold, and wet lakefront in Chicago. And it almost looks like London outside. So you got what you got. I got what I got. And in the interest of full disclosure, I think it's important. This is part of, I think, the lesson of what you brought to the table and always do. This is a restart. We had a serious technical snafu in the middle of 17 minutes in, and the computer shut down, locked up. I could do nothing. And so the engineer had to come in and figure it out, and took him time to get all that stuff. I called you a couple times, and it kind of reminded me of the lesson that maybe we should use as a leap-off point. You know, there are things that are simply out of our control, and there's nothing I can do
Amen.
About it. Right? So I spend a little time reading your book a little bit more and just kind of biding time and checking in on you. And I think that's a prevalent message for today, because in the 21st century, Jerry, we want to control everything, and that's just not possible.
It certainly is, and we just have to prepare ourselves to be flexible and to roll with the punches when necessary, but also to turn the circumstances in our favor when we can. And that's what I was able to do to a great extent, based upon an answer to my prayers there in Vietnam, was to... keep track of the lessons, the life lessons that I learned well enough to be able to pass them on after I came home. So it wouldn't just be a big void in my life of, you know, with no progress, but I could come home and capitalize on the experience.
I think that message right there, and I watched some of your videos to kind of catch up to speed to what you've been up to the last four decades, making this thing work, is I was so impressed. I'm impressed anyway, everything that you talk about, but... In particular, you were giving a talk and you said, you know, even though my experience was Vietnam and my experience was being shot down and my experience was being a prisoner of war, all of us have our own experiences that we're supposed to extract the lessons from. And one of the most challenging thing I think it is for people is to have their perspective shift happen and get out of the woe is me and the kind of like, you know, look what I can do kind of thing. And so you were in... And I tell people this all the time, you know, it's very difficult for me to get upset with traffic when I think about you. Because what you went through, well, I mean, when you really think about it, it's like, really, my biggest thing today is I had to wait in line for 5 minutes?
Yeah, exactly. Like you say, at one time or another, we were all POWs. And I call it prisoners of woe. And we need to make those times moments of learning and overcoming adversity and patience. And the way to find the bright side of almost any experience. And, you know, some of my family call me Pollyanna, and that may be true in the most pure sense. But doggone it, I think, you know, we make or break our own feelings, and we decide what to do with them. My fellow speaker, W. Mitchell, a guy that's
sure.
paraplegic, I know you know his story too. You know, his title of his book is "It Isn't What Happens to You; It's What You Do About It."
Yeah,
and that what you do about it depends upon a mindset that you can live with way before the adversity hits.
1966, you're flying combat missions over North Vietnam. You're doing some recon in your RA-5C. You're downed by enemy fire. You and your co-pilot ejected out immediately. Took some heavy damage from that, and you were captured shortly after you hit the water. Eventually made it to Hanoi, where you were jailed in this French-built prison. 7 years, 9 days, you were held as a North Vietnamese prisoner of war. All the torture and the pain and the loneliness and all these elements that went into that, that most of us, if not all of us, except for you guys that were there, could ever possibly imagine what that feels like. And so when your family's calling you Pollyanna, I'm like, so that works then, right?
It does work. Yeah. And sometimes when they give me, you know, a look sideways glance, when I'm saying something particularly optimistic, I'm pulled up short sometimes, but I have to, you know, be conscious of what I do and how it's, I'm distracted here. The Japanese tourists come over here and they rent bicycles. Mm. And a young lady just had a wreck on her bicycle in front of me here.
She all right?
I think she's going to be okay. Yeah, she's going to be okay.
She survived. Okay.
Right. Anyway, it's one of the favorite things for Japanese tourists to do, for any tourist, you know, come over and rent a bicycle and pedal through Kailua and then down to the beach park. And I don't know what caused her to topple over. I just heard her bike clatter to the ground there, and she's on her way again now. So, but anyway, that's life, you know.
Yeah, right in front of you.
It's what you do about it.
That's right. You know, you just mentioned that, and it's interesting to me because we talk about perspective shifts in life, and a lot of us, we're not real good on history. I think, Jerry, most people think history started the day they were born, and they don't look any further back. But when you do take time to look further back, and, you know, you and I and Susan had this conversation not a couple of weeks ago about the deep lessons of Vietnam, how it is in a history book somewhere. And so in many ways, you are living history as a part of that time. And the lessons should not be forgotten because we keep repeating the same shit over and over again. And just that concept you said about a lot of Japanese tourists come and ride bikes, it's so interesting to me that 75 years ago, coming up this year, that Japan was our worst enemy, and now tourists come and ride bikes there.
I know. Isn't that something that's mind-boggling, really? And when we were in Japan, we were in Tokyo and then Hiroshima, and we went to the shrine at Hiroshima, and American tourists were lined up there to pay homage, just as the Japanese tourists line up to pay homage at Pearl Harbor on the Arizona Memorial. So it's a very strange set of circumstances and it doesn't matter whether you're American or Japanese. You know, we all have the same feelings and regrets and aspirations and the need to pay attention to our history.
It's so interesting that everything to me is driven by human behavior. And I know that you've seen the worst of human behavior. Even though this happened, you know, decades ago, every time I read your book and I read, you know, what Rabbit and the rest of his crew, you know, imparted on you guys there at the Hanoi Hilton, we're so capable of great things when we still continue to act this way in the world. And I think, you know, when we see what happens in Iraq and Afghanistan and the prisoners and the beheadings and all this stuff, and people are shocked, I'm thinking, but this has been happening forever. You know, it's to me, you know, when somebody goes into a mall and becomes a suicide bomber is no different than the kamikaze pilots going into one of your Navy ships.
Well, you're absolutely right. The concept is about the same. But at least in the kamikaze situation, it was combatant against combatant. There was none of this stuff about combatant against civilians. And that's the main difference between our previous conflicts and the present one that we're involved in right now. And I just wish that we had leadership in our country right now that would choose a more efficacious way to settle this issue of terrorism and suicide bombers and the like. That's one of the most frustrating things in our modern times for our country.
When you look back at those, at how you were treated in Vietnam as a longtime prisoner of war, and you see how things are today, I know there are parallels there, and I wonder why it is that humans don't learn our lessons. I don't understand. I'm you know, a commonsensical person. I try to raise to higher ground as best I can, and it seems like this element that keeps growing as our society grows, so does that part of us, the worst part of us, exponentially. And you've spent decades insisting that we go, that the only way to eradicate that other part is that we find the best part within ourselves. Has the message gotten through? You've been doing this 40 years. Have you seen it?
Well, you know, I'll just use my book as an example. It's carried by Amazon, and I go to the Amazon website and I look at the feedback that my book elicits, and I probably have maybe close to 100 comments by readers, and at least 75 to 80% of them are 5-star grades of my book, critiques of my book, and it's really gratifying to see that people are reading that book. And it's changing people's minds. Mm-hmm. But the feedback has just been so overwhelmingly positive and encouraging. I think I got one or two 4-stars, but mostly 5-star reviews, and it's very gratifying.
The book is called Beyond Survival, Building on the Hard Times, of POW's Inspiring Story by Captain Jerry Coffey, retired. And there are these certain chunks of the book that I've always been connected to more than anything else. And the first part, I was just talking about how humans treat each other, and that even while you were confined in that cell, I mean, I remember we were talking earlier before we lost power about you being walking in that cell for the first time, and you had a decision to make. Were you going to be, because if you didn't make the decision to see this as an opportunity instead of always a liability, that you may never get out of there even mentally.
That's right, exactly. And when it became apparent how unique an experience it was going to be, particularly when seen through the eyes of the average American, I decided that I had to make the most of that as an opportunity and prepare a message for when I came home that would focus upon how tough we can be when we have to, and the differences between communism and democratic form of government. And when I shared that insight with Everett Alvarez, the first American shot down and was there at POW for almost 9 years, we were talking about what our responsibilities were going to be when we were released and came home. And he's been back in touch with me, and the conversation made a difference with him. And he's written at least 2 books: Orson Swindle, a Marine POW, mm-hmm. the same. John McCain had a chance to tell him what my sense of mission for that purpose, for that experience was. And recently, I solicited inputs from all 3 of those guys, and those are an integral part of the latest edition of Beyond Survival.
So we're going to take a real short time out this time. The power's working. We hope everything comes back. I am honored to have my friend Captain Jerry Coffey on. The book is called Beyond Survival, Building on the Hard Times, a POW's Inspiring Story. And it is at the top of the list. It's required reading if you're ready to go to the next level in life. Back with more after this. Back at it on Life Matters. And this is where common sense for uncommon times reigns supreme. The things that I get to talk about, the things that I choose to talk about, they matter. Listen, I'm not going to beat my gums over all the politics because I can't do a thing about it. I'm not going to sit. I've always said it's really, really important to know what's going on in the White House, but it's far more important to know what's going on in your house. And I want to focus on the things that you could actually apply to your life. And then you can actually get a result that's different than what you have now. To me, that has great moment to it. And I don't know anybody better to bring that message than Jerry Coffey. And the inside copy of his book, which is called Beyond Survival, it says, when life loses its meaning, when suddenly the world is turned upside down, when there's nothing left that resembles life as we've known it, where do we find the strength and sustenance to go on? And the book goes on from there about recounting his 7 years as a prisoner of Vietnam in the Vietnam War. And Jerry, you know, again, all of us at some point, you said, are prisoners. We don't want to be prisoners of woe, but it's all about that perspective shift. And one of the things that is fascinating to me, because, you know, there I don't know the exact number of POWs in all the wars over the years, but man's inhumanity, man, always seems to show itself in the worst of times. But it's your ability and other men's ability and other prisoners of war's ability to not become totally bitter, to find ways to become better, even in the worst of times. And I kept thinking over the years, as long as I've known you, that you must have learned things about yourself that you never, ever thought you would ever learn or that you would need to learn. And maybe those things help you survive in some way, shape, or form that could never be predicted.
John, you're exactly right. I look at that POW experience for 7 years and 9 days as much more of a positive experience than a negative experience. I mean, what a rare opportunity to learn about yourself. I learned the value of solitude, for example, where you have nothing to do for days and days and days except look at your life, where you've been, the experiences you've had that you've accumulated, and how best to apply those to have a happy life. You know, we frequently beat up on ourselves for not making the goals we set for ourselves. But if you're alive, taking a breath in and out, it's a learning opportunity. Dennis Prager, yeah, the radio talk show host, he's my hero from a standpoint of his integrity, mm-hmm, and his intellectual capacity. He said he wrote a book called Happiness is a Serious Problem. And in that book, he says that happiness is directly proportional to gratitude. Happiness is directly proportional to gratitude. Mm. And, you know, that means so much to me because I have so much for which to be grateful. Mm-hmm. Susan and I have a wonderful life. All those years in prison, I could never even fantasize how good my life is going to be sometime after I was released.
Wow.
And we just live every day, for, you know, one right after the other, and are so appreciative of our blessings, our family. We have 10 great-grandchildren. No, not great-grandchildren. 10 terrific grandchildren and one great-grandchildren.
Yeah.
And we're so blessed in so many ways. And so, you know, in more ways than I can even count, those 7 years in prison has been made up for by what I've been able to do since I was released, and the blessings that I've been able to enjoy.
There are two other pieces to this book that have always stuck with me. It is the concept of unity over self, that there is much more to us than meets the eye, and that in some way, shape, or form, that these challenges that show up in our life are really opportunities in disguise. And your faith, it's one thing to have faith and go to church, and that's all well and good. It's got its place. But I've always found faith to be hollow unless you actually have to live it. And then you get to define it for yourself. It's not in a Bible. It's not in a hymn. It's not in a song. It's not even in a prayer. It's something that's so personal and so relevant to your experience that it always becomes, you know, your route. And so I know that has been the bedrock, that when it was all distilled down to it was, what's your faith, Jerry? And going from that point up is another one of those wings you discovered things about yourself, but then you started redefining your faith over a period of time, and then it just kind of launched you in a whole new stratosphere. So for people specifically who have lost their faith, because I've been there, we are all there at some point, what do you say to people when they get to the point where, you know, that seems like there's nothing else going on and that they've been forgotten?
Hey, John, you're so right. And, you know, the first two English words that I saw scratched on the wall of a cell by another American in a little cell before me were two words with an equal sign between them. And that little formula simply said, God equals strength. And for me, that really worked. I was never, ever totally alone. I could always find a little bit more strength when I needed it. And that was certainly the key to my survival all those years. And you know, we just can't, if we have that feeling about spiritual faith and this and spiritual strength, we can't be embarrassed to share that, because it's a basic principle that just doesn't get shared enough, I think, for most of us. So, you know, I I'm very close to the Lord and was all those years. I wasn't going into the experience, but that experience caused me to be much closer and more appreciative of my spiritual life.
Mm. Over the years, when you do these talks and outside of the book on Amazon and people responding to it that way, and I know that you've had the experience of veterans coming up to you, talking about what your words have done for them. And have you ever felt like, you know, the old saying, many are called but few are chosen, and that you and some and the guys that were in there, everybody has kind of taken in their own way, came out of that experience to, I mean, like that was almost like a setup in some way. So for the next 40 years, you could remind us that we can be better than we think we are. Do you ever think like that?
Yeah, I do, and I try to fulfill my particular, my personal role in that scheme of things, and that's really what got me through. You know, Viktor Frankl, in his book *Man's Search for Meaning*, had a similar insight, and he decided to survive that experience in a German concentration camp, and all that went with it, so that he could come home and give the and tell that message mm-hmm. to the world. What it was like, and how he survived it, and I, you can be sure that was the first book I read after I got released and came home, and all the time I was reading it, I had been wishing that I'd read it before I went to Vietnam, because it was so pertinent and so helpful. But man's search for meaning doesn't have to be a big, complicated, and deep thing. It's all personal, and we can make that search in any different form that it happens to take and make progress for meaning in our life. And when you get to the point that I am now, she's 82 years old, and it's hard to believe, to tell you the truth, but I found my meaning. And I don't mean to sound like, hey, I've got it made, I don't have to pay attention anymore, because I don't feel that way at all. It's an ongoing process, and it never stops. And I think that's an important lesson that I drew from my experience there.
Last thing before I cut you loose, go back to your family, because I've taken up enough of your time and I can finish this a little bit. I can move on without you. I've done a couple shows without you. It's hard to believe, but I've done that. I got a couple things here. One is, before I ask you this last piece about forgiveness, I wanted to share with people while you're on the line a story, an experience that I had many, many years ago. And you don't even have to fake that you were surprised to hear this again, but it's the truth. We had done a show probably in 1998 or 1999. I don't recall what year. And we were talking about your book and all the, much like we are today. And I got a phone call or a letter after the show, don't recall which, from a woman who was just beside herself. And it took me a little time to calm her down and all that. And she relayed to me the story about her husband, who was a Vietnam veteran. He was a Marine grunt. A sergeant in Vietnam, two tours, Purple Heart, did it all and served with honor, came back home, and the only job he could find where he could be with himself or be comfortable was to be a mail carrier. He was alone, he didn't have to deal with people too much, and he did his thing. And apparently he had been listening on a little transistor radio with an earpiece back then, walking around doing his route, and he heard the show that we had done. And he came home that day after work, sat in the chair like he always does, because he would always sit in the corner, and she said he broke down and cried for 4 hours, talked to no one, just sobbing for 4 hours. And that 1999, so the war ended in, what, 73, 74, starting things changing. I don't know when he got out. So years later, this all just pussed right out of, just like broke out like a giant boil. And I think to myself, you know, here's this guy, and there's a million guys like him all over the place, that this war had twisted them inside, and they don't know who they are anymore, and they hear your message, they read your book, those type of things. And when that happens, I say there's hope. Even though there's horrible things that I can't even imagine, and most people listening to the show can't imagine, somewhere inside, you never know when the tide can turn. The right word, the right phrase, the right time, the right hug, the right handshake, the right smile, it can shift in a moment back the way it used to be.
You know, I'm so conscious when I've been traveling around to speak all over our country and several foreign countries as well. When people come up and give me some of the most incredible personal feedback about the message that they've taken away with them, and it's a very humbling experience. But every time that happens, John, it causes me to redouble my determination to use that experience to spread a positive message and to help people understand that there are, you know, they people consider me a hero, but there's a hero in each of us. And it just takes the right circumstances to bring it out so that we can be conscious of that fact. And so I always demur when people call me a hero, and I say, well, you know, we're all heroes in one way or another, and we need to remember that. And I just happen to be put into a circumstance where it was a little bit more dramatic and more visible, and where I simply did what I had to do. And what I did is within the reach of every person and every audience that I've spoken to, every person that picks up my book and reads the story has the same capacity for that heroism. And when I speak, I make a gesture toward the audience, and I say there are heroes among us today that you don't recognize because you don't look any different as a hero. But I've been very conscious that I don't hold the premium for being a hero by any means. It's in all of us, and we all have a chance for that to emerge.
The chapter that struck me the most in your book and the conversations that have been the most meaningful to me over the years, Jerry, is chapter 3 about forgiveness of oneself. And we are so hard on ourselves. We're supposed to be perfect. That's not possible. You know, here you are being interrogated, and they're wanting information out of you, and they're beating the shit out of you, and they're doing all these horrible things. And at some point, stuff comes out that you're trained to not have it come out, and that somehow you're a less of a human or a weaker man because you gave up basically nothing. But that tug of war that is in every human being, the black wolf and the white wolf that are fighting constantly for our attention, and that overriding thing that somehow forgiveness is for somebody else, I can't forgive myself because nobody else can. You've made that to me your main message.
John, it certainly is. And I have a conclusion that you can't forgive anybody unless you've already forgiven yourself. Self-forgiveness to me is very undersold. And it's not an issue that we tend to deal with. But really, to be able to forgive yourself, if you can't do that much, you're more almost powerless. But to forgive yourself gives you practice in forgiving others as well. And forgiveness is so sacred and such a constant requirement to make positive steps forward is self-forgiveness so that you can forgive others too. But it has to start with yourself.
Well, listen,
let me just add quickly, John.
Sure.
And that means understanding our humanness. That, hey, listen, you know, I've done the best that I can, and that's all we can say, that's all we can do, is to do our best. And if that isn't prove to be good enough, and then we have to focus upon the extenuating circumstances which cause us to give up without doing our best.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're only human, and we can't expect ourselves to do more than to be superhuman necessarily, but forgiving ourselves is a very, very important factor in being able to forgive anybody else.
But the forgiveness piece that you brought up, I think, is so paramount, and as you said, it's overlooked so much. That, to me, is really the place where it begins and ends. If you can't, as you said, forgive yourself, you will never be able to let go of the past, and you'll never get out of that cell. You'll always be a prisoner of woe.
You're right. I think that self-forgiveness is a key element to moving on with positive ambition and positive results. I was aware that several of my contemporaries there in Hanoi, other military officers who were POWs with me at the same time, came out with a bitter feeling about the whole experience. And those guys were not able to put any of it in a positive context. They looked at it as a waste of time and a big chunk of time out of their life and a loss that could never be recovered. And I felt so sorry for those guys who couldn't bring themselves to forgive our guards. You know, if you're released and you can't forgive them, you're continuing to give them control over you, which is the last thing that you want to do.
Mm.
For the person that you do forgive, you're giving up that control. You're putting it behind you. And that's really the secret to progress.
Well, listen, I want to thank you for sticking with us today and through all the ups and downs. I'm sure there were times when you were on the flight deck and you had to shut it down, right? So it's not so bad.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
That's
you
right.
You learn patience as a carrier aviator.
I was sitting here with my arms folded with all this machinery in my arm going, it's a dead stick. I can't do anything about it. So there you go. The book is called Beyond Survival, Building on the Hard Times, a POW's inspiring story by my friend Jerry Coffey, Amazon.com. Jerry, I want to thank you again for taking the time. It's a privilege and a pleasure over the years to do these shows with you, because I guarantee you, once this gets out, once I fix all the glitches in here and I get it up on the air, when people hear this, lives change. And I look to myself and say, once again, go back to being imprisoned all those years. The message must continue. It is part of history, but it's still part of our living history. And if we don't learn from it, we end up repeating it. So thanks for stopping by and taking time today. Give my best to Susan and get back to the beach with your grandkids.
Amen, John. Thank you so much. And it's been really, really nice to be back in touch. And I look forward to getting together with you again in the future.
You're listening to Life Matters with John St. Augustine.
Wow. It's so good to hear his voice. And to know that at that point, my voice was kind of what it sounds like now. Some of those earlier shows, I'm frickin' Mickey Mouse, and we don't need that. Anyway, I want to thank the people who are subscribers and sponsors of Life 2.0. I've been doing this about 4 years now, and this is not a huge money-making venture for me, for sure. But the people who put $20 a month in, I appreciate it. Their support means everything. It allows me to continue to do this. And it's a PBS model to some degree. You know, 80% of the people that listen to this podcast do so because the other 20% take care of it. So I am indebted to that 20%. Until next time, take care. Safe travels. Adios.